Is the red light blinking on this camera? Great.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Jonathan. And as always, grateful to Schwartzowitzki Feldman for providing great lunch. There are some sheets there on the table for those who don't already have. In a few minutes, once I think that everyone is here who's coming, I'll pass around the sign-in sheet. The sign-in sheet will get you notification of future lunches here. There's an opportunity also to sign up for a general weekly email that advertises all the programs that that my Yeshiva University, Torah Mitzion, Beit Midrash runs. So you'll be able to sign up for that as well. And we're going to learn for a refuah shlema for Miriam Ada Bas Chana, Jerry Goldberg's wife. So, and if people could please silence their phones, that would be great. Thanks. Silence, vibrate, whatever works. Okay. So the topic is use of deadly force against a terrorist. We'll deal with it both when the terrorist is attacking and the question of after the terrorist has been subdued. Generally speaking, our topics are business ethics, but I offered Jonathan a few choices, and he chose the general ethics choice as opposed to the business ethics one. We'll get to the back to business ethics presumably in the new year.
I think it was more like in the Yalidiyomah.
So yeah. It's fine. There's a basic tension that Judaism has whenever you deal with topics like this, issues of military, issues of self-defense, and that is that on the one hand, the Torah says, "Verachamava kol ma'asav," that Hashem's mercy is upon all of His creations, and the Rambam draws on that in terms of our relationship with society. We're supposed to make sure always to exercise mercy. The ways of the Torah are supposed to be pleasant. The Gemara in Sanhedrin notes that Jews are supposed to be three things, and one of them is Rachmanim. We're supposed to be merciful people. And so much so that it actually says that if you see someone who is identified as Jewish who isn't merciful but who is cruel, you actually have to wonder about their heritage. So, that's supposed to be a hallmark of who we are. At the same time, we have a basic principle, Havala Hargacha Hashkem L'Hargo. If someone comes to kill you, you better get up early to kill them first. There's an issue of self-defense. And so we have difficulty dealing with this sort of a case, the question of what to do in defending ourselves against terrorism. So if you take a look on your sheet at source number one, this is a piece from Reuters, which sums up the problem in terms of the recent stretch of attacks. Writer is Jeffrey Heller. Title is U.S. Excessive Force Comment Touches Nerve in Israel. At a daily press briefing on Wednesday, U.S. State Department spokesman John Kirby said Israel, which has set up roadblocks in East Jerusalem where many of the Palestinian attackers resided, has a right and responsibility to protect its citizens. He added, "Now, we have seen some, I wouldn't call the checkpoints this, but we've certainly seen some reports of what many would consider excessive use of force. Obviously, we don't like to see that, and we want to see restrictions that are elevated in this time of violence to be as temporary as possible if they have to be enacted," Kirby said, without citing specific incidents. So, in the process of defending Israel's measures, he also notes a concern for what he calls excessive force. Asked at a news conference for the foreign media in Jerusalem about those remarks, Netanyahu said, "What do you think would happen in New York if you saw people rushing into crowds trying to murder people? What do you think they would do? Do you think they would do anything differently than we are doing?" So his response is, that's not excessive. This is a normal response, and it's a necessary response. On Thursday, Kirby insisted there had been no U.S. finger pointing at Israel. "I want to be very clear that we have never accused Israeli security forces of excessive force with respect to these terrorist attacks." I'm not quite sure how that squares with his earlier remarks. Was this simply diplomatic backtracking, or was there a distinction to be made? We heard reports of excessive force, what many would consider, but we don't consider it. Unclear exactly how to square that circle. But the fundamental question is, what constitutes excessive force? And when is it okay? When is it not okay? So what I want to do is divide this up into two situations. The first, use of deadly force on an attacker, and within that, use of deadly force by the target of the attack, as opposed to use of deadly force by a third party. And then, once we've dealt with that, the question of after the terrorist is subdued, now what do? Knowing full well what the pattern is, which is that they tend to be arrested, and they're in jail for a period of time, and then they are released, or they're released in a prisoner exchange, and then they return to terrorism, which there is a track record of doing, despite all of the deals to the contrary. So the question then is, so what's the responsibility of somebody who is there when the terrorist is subdued and has the opportunity to end the threat by killing the terrorist? So those are our fundamental questions. And there are still a few more sheets over there. So we begin with the question of the victim who uses excessive force. The attacker had a knife. The victim turns around with a gun and kills the attacker. Now, you'll say, well, that's not excessive force. The attacker was trying to kill him with the knife, and subduing a person with a knife looks a lot easier in the movies than it is in real life. Who is to say that this is excessive force? So let's pretend for a moment that we were able to define a case in which you knew this actually was excessive. It was more than was necessary. So, for example, the person with the knife is coming running at this person, and instead of shooting the person in the legs, the person shoots them in the chest. And assuming that, which is a big assumption, they had the time to think and they had the opportunity and the skill level to be able to target the person in some other way. These are all big assumptions. But let's pretend that those are givens, because that's what creates the case at hand. So we do have a basic principle that even the victim, all other things being equal, is not supposed to use excessive force. Meaning that when the Torah licenses somebody to kill their to license somebody to fend off their attacker, they're not supposed to use too much force. They're supposed to use the minimum that they need to use. So, for example, if you take a look at source number 2, from the Sifsei Chachamim, which is a commentary on Rashi, there's a situation in the book of Bereishit of Genesis in which Yaakov, returning back to the land of Canaan, encounters his brother Esav, who wants to kill him. And the Torah describes the situation and says, Vayira Yaakov me'od vayetzer lo. It says Yaakov was very afraid and he was upset. And that's difficult. The sages are bothered. If you already said he was afraid, what did you add by saying he's upset? What does that even mean? He's pained? What does that mean? And so the Midrash on it, and Rashi quotes, it says, he was afraid that he might be killed, and he's upset that he might kill somebody else. So the Sifte Chachamim commentary in source number 2, commenting on Rashi, says, I don't understand. He's upset that he might kill somebody. The rule is, somebody attacks you, you're supposed to kill him. What's the question? And so his answer is that Yaakov is worried that he might do so unnecessarily. That it could be he will use excessive force, and Yaakov is disturbed by that possibility. That's one source. There are many you could bring, but that's one of them. I brought another one in source number 3. Source number 3 is dealing with case in which one ox attacks another ox. And Rabbeinu Asher, a halachic authority, I give you the timeline there, 13th century, he lived in Germany, then he fled persecution in Germany and went to Spain. And he says that in the case where one ox attacks another one, and then the second one retaliates, he says the second ox may attack the first, since he started. The first one was the one who attacked. And he says, even with people, I brought the Hebrew so that people would have it, but I'm going to read the English specifically for the sake of time. Even with people, where you have two people who are fighting, one attacked the other and the other defended himself, the second one is permitted to respond. But one must say that where he could have saved himself by inflicting a small wound, and he wounded greatly, he is liable. The victim of the attack struck back and did more than he needed to do. He is liable for doing so. Like the case of one who could have saved via one of his limbs and instead killed the attacker. Now, he's talking about financial liability in a case of injury. He's not dealing with the case of killing the attacker. He's talking about financial liability. He says one would be liable for doing more than was necessary. This makes it into the IDF, the Israel Defense Forces, doctrine called in Hebrew Tohar HaNeshek, or purity of arms. And I brought it here, source number 4 from the IDF's website. The soldier shall make use of his weaponry and power only for the fulfillment of the mission and solely to the extent required. He will maintain his humanity even in combat. The soldier shall not employ his weaponry and power in order to harm non-combatants or prisoners of war, and shall do, this is the key, shall do all he can to avoid harming their lives, body, honor, and property. It's the responsibility of the soldier to avoid causing unnecessary harm. So that's on one level. We've said the victim isn't supposed to use excessive force. However, when we get to the codes of Jewish law on this topic, they rule that one is not liable for doing so. In other words, you had somebody who was being pursued. He turned around and he shot the guy. He had the opportunity, let's pretend, he had the opportunity to shoot him in some way that wouldn't actually kill him, but he didn't. Maimonides rules, it's in Hilchot Malachim, I didn't bring it on the sheet, but it's in Hilchot Malachim, the laws of kings and their wars, chapter 9, law number 4. He says explicitly there is no liability. You're not supposed to do it, but you're not liable for having done so. Why wouldn't you be liable for having done so, logically? So we have two different answers that are offered here. One answer, Chaim says, is because ein lo damim. The rule is that somebody who attacks has suspended his right to claim blood, so to speak. In other words, he exposes himself to potentially being killed in response. That's one potential approach, and we're going to see that. The other answer is heat of the moment. What's he supposed to do? Can he really make that kind of a calculation? If he guesses wrong, he thought he could shoot the guy in the legs and immobilize him, and we've seen video now of recent attacks where somebody gets shot multiple times and keeps on coming. If he guesses wrong, it's his own life that's going to be forfeit. So you can't hold somebody liable for that. And take a look at source number 5, the Maharshal, Rabbi Shlomo Luria, gave that argument. He gave the argument in a different case. He talks about a case in which one person insults another one, and the other responds by hitting him. And he says that what the second one does is wrong. He's not supposed to do it. He's violated a prohibition. But we're not going to call him a wicked person. His heart was boiling, as he puts it. He doesn't stand by when in pain, and that's certainly going to be true when somebody is defending his own life. So what we've seen is that the victim isn't the intended victim, at any rate, is not supposed to use excessive force if he can avoid it, but he's not liable for having done so. That leads to a question regarding a particular story in Tanakh. And if you haven't learned the story, it can be a little confusing. So I gave you a little bit of a digest here on the page in under source number 6. I'm going to pass around the sign-in sheet now that I mentioned earlier for people to be able to sign in for notification about either follow-up on this program or notification of future lunches here. And I'll give you a pen to use. I always leave my pen here. I've donated so many pens to Schwartzlewski Feldman. Okay, there you go. That's okay, because I got them from hotels. The source number 6 deals with a story from Tanakh regarding a general by the name of Avner. And this is dealing with the battle that went back and forth between Saul's men, King Saul's men, and King David's men. Right? Because remember that Samuel, was sent by God to commit what is essentially a crime in the Middle East. It's a very bad idea, which is to coronate the new king before the old king is dead. It's a bad idea, and it doesn't work. And indeed, this was quite the crisis there. The battle that goes on back and forth in which Shaul is pursuing David continues even after Shaul actually is dead with the next generation. So what we see here, and what I'm summarizing here, and I gave you the references to look it up in the parentheses in source number 6, is the following. There's a general by the name of Avner. Avner works for Ish-Boshet, who is the son of Shaul, of King Saul. There's another general by the name of Yoav. Yoav works for King David. So there's a contest between Avner's men and Yoav's men. And what's going on with the contest is its own discussion, but King David's men are winning. So the ones led by Yoav. One of them is a very fast runner, a dangerous man, by the name of Asael. And Asael is running after Avner. Avner warns him off twice. He says, don't do it, don't make me kill you. Avner warns him twice, unsuccessfully. Asael keeps on coming. And Avner turns around and kills him. But he doesn't just kill him. It's described in the text that he stabs him at the fifth rib, a particular spot where he's going to be vulnerable. That's one story. Story number two is that Yoav, whose brother was Asael, so he's his kin, Yoav lures Avner and into a trap and kills Avner. So Yoav avenges the blood of his brother by killing Avner. There's a separate story in which Yoav then kills another man by the name of Amasa, who had been named a general in his place. And King David, before he dies, tells his son Shlomo, his son Solomon, "V'asita kechokhmatecha, act according to your wisdom in dealing with what remains of this terrible, this back and forth murder." So Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon, charges his general Benayahu ben Yehoyada to take care of things. And that brings us to source number 7 and the way the Talmud reads the trial of Yoav. So again, Avner killed Yoav's brother. Yoav killed Avner. So here we get the back and forth in source number 7. He, Benayahu, brought Yoav and judged him. He said to him, he says to Yoav, "Why'd you kill Avner?" This is the key question. Yoav replied, "Because I'm the redeemer of Asael's blood. I was justified in doing so. He killed my brother." What the concept is of a redeemer of blood is a great discussion, but not for right now. Right now we're just going to assume there is such a thing and that he's claiming license under that. To which the response from Benayahu is, Asael was trying to kill him. It's self-defense. He may have killed your brother, but it was self-defense when he did so. So therefore, he was justified. To which Yoav says, no, Avner used excessive force. Because he could have accomplished the same thing. He could have driven off Asael by just, you know, hitting him in the arm, the leg, whatever it was. To which the response is, but he couldn't have done that. Benayahu says to him, there was no opportunity for him to do that, for him to stop Asael without killing him. To which Yoav replies, I read the story. Avner was able to strike precisely enough. He could pick the fifth rib as the spot where he's going to strike him. You're going to tell me he didn't have the opportunity to strike him in some other way that wouldn't have killed him? And then the trial moves on from this to ask him, why'd you kill Amasa? So from this story, as it's presented here in the Talmud, it sounds like we're saying that there is a concept of not using excessive force, that he's not supposed to use excessive force, and if he could have done it without killing him, then indeed he is liable for having killed him. Avner is going to be held. Avner was wrong for killing Asael, and therefore Yoav was justified in killing Avner. There was a question here. And then.
There's an implication that this being struck in the fifth rib, that was losing.
Yes.
This report, you stick my throat at you. I hit you in the head. Right. Does that mean I aimed for your head?
Right.
It just says, and I hit you in the head.
Right, but the implication of the text is that it was a spot of vulnerability, and that's why he chose it, and it was that was what he meant to hit him. It isn't just that it was an accident. Yeah, Neil.
The way you present it sounds like excessive force is killed. It's not the type of wound, because worse wounds or less bad wounds to stop the person. But in this case, you're saying excessive force.
Right. So Neil's point is well taken. There are two types of excessive force. One is the fatal force we're talking about here. And the other is you hit him more than you needed to and you caused some kind of damage. So there we already said he would be liable. There we saw this statement from the Rush in source number 3 that one would be liable for using excessive force that caused financial harm. The question is liability for death. And what we're saying is that there's no liability, although now it sounds like there is. In this story of Avner, it sounds like Avner is liable, and that's why Yoav is justified in killing him. Janice?
I guess I'll play a little bit of devil's advocate. The laws and the people involved here are all Jews. So these are halakhas that demonstrate with killing or the injury of another Jew. What does that extend to the non-Jews, or is there something different?
Right. So there's a difference in the laws when it comes to who the intended victim of the attacker is, in terms of liability if somebody who was attacked is Jewish or non-Jewish when he strikes back at the attacker. There we draw a distinction. However, you don't see the Rambam make any distinction when he codifies this in terms of who the attacker was. He doesn't draw that distinction. There's more to be said about it, but the Rambam does not make any distinction. And you'll see it actually in the next line in number 8. But the question is, if we've said you're not liable for using excessive force to defend yourself, then why is it that Avner is, you know, held for what he did to Asael, and Yoav is justified in killing him? So one approach, the Kesef Mishnah, Rabbi Yosef Karo, says the answer is don't take that passage in source number 7 literally. Meaning this wasn't really the trial of Yoav and so forth. Yoav is a dead man. The only question is the discussion as to why exactly he's going to be killed. And the don't take the trial as an actual trial and this as a real case. He says don't take it too literally, don't extrapolate legal principles from there. Yes?
Possibly we're dealing with the intent here. You, for example, it could be an accident, and it could be an intent.
Right, no, this is assumed to be intentional.
Right.
Yeah, this is assumed to be intentional. The accidental would be a whole other ballgame. Okay, so we've said that the victim himself, while he's not supposed to use excessive force, is generally assumed not to be liable. What about a bystander? What about a police officer? Right, we've had one of our sessions was on police brutality several months ago. But what would we say then? And the answer is that the bystander is liable but not liable. Take a look at source number 8. Rambam Maimonides writes, anyone who can save, meaning save the victim, with one of the pursuer's limbs, meaning that he could have hit him in the arm, hit him in the leg, stopped him that way, and he doesn't strain to do that, but instead saves at the expense of the pursuer's life. He says, I'm going to sit there trying to hit him in the leg. Let me shoot him and he'll die and that'll be that. So one who does that, killing him, has shed blood and is liable for death, but the court doesn't kill him. So he's liable. It's considered to be a capital crime. However, Beit Din, the rabbinical court, is not going to carry out the execution. When it comes to a bystander, the bystander is indeed expected to be more careful. And I brought you a source supporting that in source number 9, an argument by Rivash, which I'll skip for now, but you can see it there if you want to take a look at it. We do distinguish between what's expected of a victim and what's expected of a bystander. His point, Rivash's point, is that if it's a victim, he's the target of the attack. So he's not expected to now warn the attacker. You know, if you do this, you're liable for whatever. He's running. He's conserving his breath. Whereas the bystander is actually expected to go through that type of a warning, assuming the situation allows for it. There are different expectations. Yeah?
But the thing is that the bystander could potentially also turn into a potential victim. So when does the bystander become still going to stay a bystander? When does the bystander?
That's a really good question. At what point does someone stop being a bystander? What if he's not the immediate target, but he could become one? I think you could make the argument both ways. You could make the argument that where he's next, so to speak, he's a victim, but you could just as easily make the argument that what distinguishes bystander from victim is that the bystander has the opportunity to make a decision, which the victim doesn't. And I think that even if he's the eventual target, right now he has the opportunity to make that kind of an assessment and figure out what he's going to do. I'm going to hold questions right now just because there's a lot to go through. But take a look at source number 10. The big question is, if you're telling me he's liable, and that's what Maimonides has written, why is it that he's not killed by the rabbinical court? Why does the Beit Din say, we're not going to execute him? So Rabbi David Ibn Avi Zimra, who's known as Radbaz, starts out in Spain and then makes Aliyah, he writes regarding this question, this is no question at all. As a pursuer, he has abandoned himself for death. And this goes back to what Chaim said earlier. For he knows that the target will defend his life. Meaning, we have a basic principle which goes back to biblical law about someone who breaks and enters into somebody's house. The principle is, Ein lo damim, he has no blood, literally. If somebody breaks into a person's house, he knows full well that the people at home are going to defend themselves if they catch him, and that they may well use deadly force, and he does this anyway. And therefore, he suspends any rights to claim his life from them. So in this case, he has, as Radbaz puts it, hifkir atzmo lemisa, he has abandoned himself for death. And there are similar ideas expressed by others in this regard, that he's not killed. The reason why the bystander is not killed is fundamentally because of the actions of the attacker. The attacker knew full well and abandoned himself to the possibility of being killed, because the victim could have turned around and killed him without any liability, and therefore there's nothing further to say regarding regarding punishing the bystander who killed him. That's the basic principle. Are we clear on that point? Just because we're getting to the end of this subtopic of this first half. The basic principle is a victim is not supposed to use excessive force, but has no liability. A bystander is liable for excessive force, but the rabbinical court will not carry it out. Because ultimately, this fellow who attacked knew that he could lose his life in this regard. And therefore, he's abandoned himself to death. I'll take two questions, and then we'll go to the second half. Yes?
Okay. So, the Sami Yatim trial, that was very interesting. So, is the policeman on a different madrega, or is he, like, he should know better?
So what I will do, God willing, is I will email you the link to the police brutality class that we had here, because that was one of the topics. I'll send you the link for the recording of that one, because it's a very good question, and it applies when you deal with soldiers as well. And yes, having higher expectations for people who are trained.
Right.
Okay, Chaim, and then we'll...
If Hashem's the one who determined Eli Dunning, then why is Hashem causing him to be liable?
If Hashem says Ein lo damim, right? Because the bystander still wasn't supposed to do it. It's just that the court isn't going to carry it out.
So really, he is damim.
He's wrong in terms of his own actions, but not so wrong that the court is going to actually carry out this punishment. The truth of the matter is that what you're saying is right. In other words, how can you even call him liable if the victim was somebody who wasn't entitled to that defense? And maybe that's what motivates the Bede Kabayis, gives another explanation altogether, which is, it's a minority view, but maybe this is the answer. He says it's because there was no valid warning to the bystander. Meaning, in order for a person to be killed by a rabbinical court, they have to have been warned and have witnesses and so forth. You couldn't give the bystander a proper warning, because the bystander isn't performing an act of murder, he's performing an act of saving someone's life. So that's his argument for why. Could be he's concerned by your point that there should be no liability at all if the answer is hifkir atzmo. Maybe. There's more on it if you want to give me more sources on this issue. But let's move to the second question, which is the volatile one, I think. I think you won't see somebody on trial for having defended himself against an attacker with a knife and having killed the attacker in the process. Whether he was right or wrong, you're not going to see them on trial for it. The question is, what about the attacker who has already been subdued? There's a story they tell, which has come under question in recent years, about the 35 Palmach fighters who were on their way to save Gush Etzion. If you're familiar with the story was that they were on their way to save Gush Etzion in the War of Independence, and along the way they're discovered by an old Arab shepherd, and they don't know what to do, because if they kill the shepherd, he's not an attacker, you know, by what right would they do that? On the other hand, if they let him go, he could tell everybody their location, and they decide to let him go. And sure enough, he tells them, and they're attacked, and they're massacred, and Gush Etzion is lost until 67. The story is told by David Ben-Gurion in the eulogy that he delivers afterwards. And there's some debate in recent years based on British documents from the time as to whether that's exactly the way the story played out. But the question is fundamentally, what do you do at this point, knowing that your mercy on somebody right now could result in them coming back to attack later. Yeah.
Why couldn't they bring them with them?
Yeah. Yes.
And the answer is because you are on your way on foot to try to save people in the Etzion block. You're going to carry this the shepherd with you who is not interested in cooperating. Rather difficult to imagine. I mean, we can come up with all sorts of what ifs. What if you tied him up and left him some water with him? What if? Yeah, I don't know. There are two arguments against using deadly force, or two classes of arguments, and then there are two arguments justifying deadly force. What argument would you give against using deadly force? Well, he's not innocent. He was trying to kill people. We're not dealing with a shepherd. We're dealing with the attacker who had a knife. They subdued him now. They're sitting on top of him. They're tying him up, whatever it is. Yeah.
To save more people. To save the lives of all the
people. No. The reasons against using deadly force. The reasons not to kill him.
Because he's now... He isn't a threat anymore. He isn't a threat.
Right. The first answer is because he's not an immediate threat. If we're not supposed to use, you know, excessive force during an attack, how much more so when he's not currently attacking? Yes, Neil.
There's also a reason that he's also a source of intelligence.
Right. The argument is made that you could interrogate. Now, I read through some papers on the issue of interrogation and torture and whether you can rely on what they say. There's an article that I read by Dov Zakheim in which he notes that John McCain, when he was a prisoner of war in Vietnam, so he, when they kept asking him the names of the rest of his unit, he told them the defensive line for the Green Bay Packers. He just gave them the names of the football players. In other words, they're not going to give you accurate information. They're not on your side. So you have to be aware of that. But argument number two against deadly force is a class of arguments that suggest, all of them together, that it's counterproductive. For you to use deadly force against the subdued attacker ultimately is counterproductive. And there are a few who give this argument. One, I brought you in source number 11, Rabbi Yehuda Herzl Henkin, whose son, Rabbi Tam Henkin, was killed in the Sukkot attack. But Rabbi Yehuda Herzl Henkin dealt with this question, and his argument was Chilul Hashem, desecrating God's name. And he said, in truth, there is desecration of God's name even with actions that are legal, and even during war. And he gives you an example from the story of the Givonim, the Gibeonites. The Givonim is a clan or a tribe that live in Canaan. When the Jews enter into the land, they send messengers saying, you have three choices. You can fight us if you want, you can flee if you want, or you can accept the Noahide laws, and then you'll be at peace with us. Those are your three choices. You'll pay tribute, but you'll be at peace with us. Those are your three choices. The Gibeonites, the Givonim, do not opt for any of the above. Instead, they play a game. They come to him, the emissaries of the Gibeonites come to Yehoshua, to Joshua, and they say, we're from really far away. We're not one of these Canaanites that you're supposed to go to war with, and we want to make a treaty with you. And make a long story short, Yehoshua accepts their offer. He's taken in, and then he finds out that they're from next door. And what are we supposed to do? We're going to honor the treaty. And the treaty ends up drawing the Jews into a major war, as other tribes there are angry at the Givonim and go to war against them. And the Jews are drawn into defending the Givonim. But the upshot of it, as Rabbi Henkin notes, is that the verse says the children of Israel did not strike them, for the leaders of the nation had sworn to them. You made a deal, you stick to it. And the Talmud says, why did they stick to the deal, as he quotes in source number 11? Because of the sanctity of God's name. It's an issue of what people will say if you break your deal. Even though you're justified, it was a deal made with fraud, nonetheless, he argues you have to be concerned for what everybody else is going to say.
Are you basically saying it's a slippery slope? Meaning if you...
No slippery slope. He's saying... If you kill a subdued terrorist, the world is...
You may even...
No, not the next time. He's saying if you kill a subdued terrorist, then the world is going to look at you as the equal of the terrorist. That's his argument. That's another story. I didn't get to the responses. Right now I'm on this side of the coin. Rabbi, I'm going to go further because there's a lot to say here, and I want to make sure to say it clearly. Rabbi David Stav, in source number 12, makes a different argument, but along the same lines, that is counterproductive. He says, these days, when the boiling blood is mixed with civilian willingness and resourcefulness, meaning when our attackers are civilians, these people, he says it's important to maintain our moral superiority. To avoid harming a person, actually maybe he means the civilians on our side, I'm not even sure. But he says, to avoid harming a person who is not involved in murderous activity, and to avoid harming those who have already been neutralized and no longer pose a danger. It's not because they are innocent. They deserve to die, but that is not our way. Harming a terrorist who has been neutralized causes double damage. The collateral damage is when these images are distributed, and the main damage is harming our moral norms. We will not stoop down to our enemy's despicable behavior. We will not contaminate ourselves with a moral breakdown. That's his argument, is the morality of it. And then the third argument that's in this class is number 13, and then I'll come back to your question. But the third argument is Rabbi Yaakov Ariel, who says, you know, you're going to turn them into martyrs. Right? What you're going to do is exactly what they want. They want to be killed. It just means that it generates more attacks from them. As he puts it, it adds fuel to the fire. So he says, you haven't actually helped yourself by killing this person. So this set of arguments, which I include together, is basically that it's counterproductive. Whether it's counterproductive because of what the world is going to do to us in response, whether it's counterproductive because it damages our moral standing, or whether it's counterproductive because it just incites them further and it doesn't act as a deterrent. It's not as though any of them says, well, the last one to attack them got killed, I guess I won't attack them now. That doesn't seem to be working. So he says it's counterproductive. Question.
Well, going back to World War II, did Hitler sign treaties and then renege? And didn't people say about the Jews, of why didn't they fight? Why didn't they defend themselves?
Their lack of self-defense didn't stem from believing that things were going to be fine. It stemmed from powerlessness.
No, but not at the beginning. Not in the early.
Yes,
but
some did.
Early times, they didn't.
Correct.
But, you know, signing treaties, like you said, it's fraudulent or people.
Right. I want to make sure to distinguish. Right. I should distinguish between the individual attacker and the individual case and signing a treaty. Because there are other factors that come into play when you're dealing with national relations and trusting groups to sign treaties that I don't think are involved when you're dealing with the particular individual at hand who has not signed any treaty. In other words, the attacker, if you were to freeze the moment in time and ask him, will you attack as soon as you get out of jail? The answer is yes. He's not even lying about it. I don't think it's analogous to the treaty case. Yes? You
that
tell me.
It seems to be a little bit
Levy
as well as mostly beyond that.
Right. I think Shimon and Levy is much more along the treaty type of a case. You mix in other factors, which is the people of Shechem have no interest in attacking them and have displayed no interest in attacking them. The problem with them is the rape they've committed, not something that they're planning on doing tomorrow. So I think it's a little bit of a different story in terms of Shimon Halevi. I wouldn't mix that in with this. I think it's a complete population rather than an individual. I'm not sure I'd bring that into this.
But you're talking about being in a state of war, right? When they were going out.
Well, that's where we're going.
And the Arab was there, and they didn't take him or they didn't kill him. They're in a state of war, so they're allowed to do that.
Hang on, we're getting there. Marvin, you had a question? So what we see here are two arguments against. Right? You're not under immediate threat, and it's counterproductive. The arguments for are basically two. One is that this is war, and war has a different set of rules. And the other is that he is going to attack again, and therefore he's considered an attacker right now, even though it's not immediate. So let's see first arguments first. And you can see, by the way, I don't know if you noticed, but I give the centuries for this. The first set of sources that I brought on use of deadly force during an attack were all old issues, old sources, and so forth. All the sources that I'm bringing now, almost all of them on the subdued attacker, are fundamentally 21st century. In other words, they're dealing with this question right now, and many of them, their articles were written in the last few months, not by Henkin, but others were the last few months responding to the very real case at hand. So the argument that this is war is made by Rav Dov Lior in source number 14. He says, by the way, where's the sign-in sheet?
It's going around.
Okay, please make sure that it goes around, because what I want to do afterwards, when I follow up, God willing, I'm going to send out the digital version of this, and that way you'll be able to click on the links for the original articles and see them, because retyping them from the sheet is hard. So, in source number 14, Rabbi Lior writes, an attacking terrorist comes in the name of his nation, and his goal is to strike any Jew in any way. And therefore, this is considered not a criminal act, but a war against the Jewish nation. You know, it's a criminal act if somebody breaks into a house to steal something. It's a criminal act if somebody has a particular person he wants to assassinate or kill, whatever it is. This person is just opening fire or stabbing whoever he finds in the market. So that's not a criminal act. That's actually war. And war has different rules. So, for example, I brought you source number 15, which is regarding the story of Shimon and Levi. The source number 15, a comment of Maharal, where he writes, Deuteronomy chapter 20, sentence 10, says, when you go to war, the first thing you do is call for peace. But that is where they have not acted upon Israel. That's where the people you are now against haven't done something to you. Where they have acted towards Israel, such as here, the story of Shechem, where they had broken forth doing this repellent thing, then even though only one of them had done it, since they had attacked first, Israel was permitted to respond. That's his defense of Shimon and Levi. So too for all wars. Even where only one of them had acted, he is part of the nation, and since they attacked first, we were permitted to go to war against them. So the argument is, it's not about this individual's life and whether he is an attacker right now or not. Rather, it's the bigger question of viewing this as a war, and in war, people die. And that's part of self-defense. This is the way you fight the war. Rabbi Avram Shapira made this point in source number 16. His discussion was, I believe, this was 2006, when he engaged in a debate in the journal, actually no, the Truman one is older. The Truman one, I think, was the 80s, after the war in Lebanon. I was thinking of something else. But Rabbi Avram Shapira says, when there is no substantive risk to our soldiers, there is no permission to strike lives or property. However, when there is a discernible risk, one must remember that it is not only a matter of weighing one unit opposite a civilian population on the scale. The loss of one unit or part of it can affect the entire battle. He's dealing with the problem of collateral damage, civilian damage. But his point stands here as well. You need to protect your own soldiers. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein wrote in response that you have to be very careful about that kind of a logic. In source number 17, he says, it isn't a simple calculation. You have to be very careful about how you apply that kind of logic. He says, don't be so quick to do this. But that's the argument, is this is war, and war is different. The same argument, actually, I'm not going to say the same argument, I'm going to apply it differently, sorry. That's one argument, is this is war. The second argument is that he is going to attack, even if he's not attacking right now. And that brings us to source number 18 and the following incident. I'll explain it outside of the text because I think it requires explanation. The Jews get out of Egypt, right? Before they get to the sea, the Egyptians come running after them. The Egyptians have chariots. What do you use to pull your chariots? Horses. We were told, though, that in one of the last of the plagues, one of the last of the Makot, the plague of hail, all the animals that were out in the fields died. Where'd they get horses from? And the answer is that the biblical verse says, Hayareyas Devar Hashem, those who were afraid of God's word, those who believed the warning, brought their animals in from the field. So the Egyptians who believed what God was doing and believed what Moshe was saying, they brought in their animals. And those are the ones who turned around and attacked the Jews with these chariots, leading to a midrashic comment, which is what Tosfos quotes in source number 18. The text reads one or two ways. In some editions, it says kosher shebeknanim. In the other text, it says kosher shebemitzrim. It's the same idea. The kosher among the Canaanites, you shall kill. Which he explains to mean, as Tosfos continues, this is talking about during war. And what it's saying is, even the good guys may turn around and attack you. And therefore you have to be very careful about saying, well, this person is different or this person is subdued. Ultimately, this person may well turn around and attack you. And that's the position taken by numerous rabbis in Israel today. I brought you some. Source number 19, Rabbi Shmuel Eliyahu, who also speaks out very harshly against the idea of Rabbi Stav, that you shouldn't become barbaric like the other side, and the argument for Chilul Hashem, that it's desecration of God's name, he discounts that also. But he writes, fundamentally, you don't take risks. This is a person who has tried to kill people, and he will try again. So don't play games. That's his argument. Neil.
You have the opportunity to defend yourself. Very common. If the attacker gets somebody hurt, he would come back later to kill the person.
Right. No, it's absolutely true. And you have this. Yes, one, and then I'll go on.
I was thinking the leader of the country, your enemy, isn't cracking down on the vigilantes or, you know, the people going out stabbing.
Yeah.
So if they're not saying let's live in peace, they're declaring war. So all the civilians are the enemy.
Right. Well, that's the war argument. That's part of the war argument.
Even if they're innocent, they're still.
But what we're saying is that even if it's not a war situation, but this person is going to come back again, they are considered a pursuer now. And the argument of they've been subdued is not relevant because they're going to attack in the future. That's this.
But like I said, the leaders are putting the civilians in a dangerous.
Right. No, but that, and that's.
And they're not
right.
Telling them to leave the country, go somewhere safe. They're putting them in
target. Wait, you know, leaders of which country?
Of like the West Bank or whatever.
Yeah.
They're using them as shields. They're putting innocent people's lives at risk, so they're not really caring about their own civilians.
But they, again, that can fit under the war heading. That won't help in terms of the question of is this person considered an attacker or not. It'll only be a potential contributing factor in the question of are we at war or not. They're really two different issues. I wouldn't mix the two. Because ultimately to this person at hand, and in this particular situation, what does it matter what the leader of his group is doing? But the argument that he's considered an attacker is one that has basis long ago. It's not a new idea. If you take a look at source number 20, Rabbi Moshe Tsuriel quotes this. Ralbag, Rabbi Levi ben Gershom, in his commentary to Malachim Aleph, the King's One, what he does in his commentaries on the Navi, on the prophets, in many cases is, at the end of a chapter or a series of chapters, Ralbag brings you a number of practical lessons that you can learn from the events of that chapter. So this is lesson number 34 that he brings after a series of chapters. He says, if someone who was always a painful thorn for him and his nation should fall into his hands in war, it will be appropriate not to have mercy on him, but to eliminate him from the land, lest he find another opportunity, should he escape, to destroy him and his nation as he is able. You have to be wary about the possibility that he's going to come back and that he's going to and that he's going to attack again. You can't make the assumption that that everything is going to be fine after this person is released. I think this didn't get to the back row. No. You can just pass that back around. Thanks. I want to make sure they have the chance to sign in. So that's definitely a concern. If you remember the story of Agag, right? Shaul goes to war against Agag and Amalek. He wipes them out almost. He leaves Agag alive. So people note that Haman is Agagi, a descendant of Agag in the Purim story. But even without that, just a few chapters later in the prophets, you find Amalek attacks and they burn the city of Ziklag and they take all of the women captive. Like this is the type of case that we're describing. And there's a concern that if you let him go, it's going to come back to hurt you. In source number 21, Radak, Rabbi David Kimchi, wrote fairly briefly on it. He says, "Mercy on the wicked is cruelty, for it is known that they will wage war in the end." So this is the argument that is brought to say that even if he's not attacking right now, that doesn't mean he's not considered a pursuer. I want to get through one last point here. The question you do have to ask, and it's very difficult to answer, is the question of how sure you need to be. What if you think he would attack, but you don't know? You have no means of knowing whether he would attack or not. So this is actually an old debate. It came up a lot in the discussions about prisoner exchanges and the question of whether you can free a terrorist with the possibility that he's going to come back to attack. And there were two different perspectives. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, as well as Rabbi Usher Weiss, I brought it in source number 22 for Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, says you have to know for sure. He's dealing with a separate question. He's dealing with a question of aborting a fetus where there's concern that carrying the fetus to term could kill the mother. And so he says the fetus is considered a pursuer of the mother. But in order to kill a pursuer, you have to know that they're a pursuer. And therefore you need medical certainty, as much as that's possible, that that's in fact what we're talking about. And that's the argument he brings there, and it's quoted here to say you really need to know that this person would attack. It's not enough that you think it would happen. That's one school of thought. Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach, I brought in number 23, as well as Rabbi Yisrael Meir Lau, argue the other way. And they say no. He says, look, if the Torah allows you to kill someone who breaks and enters into your home because you think that person would kill, but you don't actually know, you don't have any certainty of that. It could be. He's not that kind of burglar. So you don't know, and yet the Torah says that you defend yourself and you're allowed to defend yourself at the cost of his life. So he says clearly you don't need certainty. This is a very real and substantive debate about how sure you need to be. So to sum up what we've said regarding question number two, the question of the attacker who has been subdued, arguments against are you're not under immediate threat, and it will be counterproductive either on a practical level or on a moral level. You have the two different arguments. And then arguments justifying deadly force are either this is war, and in war, you don't stop. You know, at the moment when you say, well, he's not trying to kill me right now, this is a battle against an enemy military. And the second argument is because he's going to attack again when he gets the opportunity. Well, then the question is, how sure do you have to be that he would attack again? And that's subject to debate. I trust that no one came here expecting simple answers, and this is what we do. The answer is it's a very live, practical debate that's currently going on. I brought you the last source, number 24, just because you have to. You can't deal with this topic without seeing the words from Golda Meir. When peace comes, we will perhaps in time be able to forgive the Arabs for killing our sons, but it will be harder for us to forgive them for having forced us to kill their sons. Harking back to the comment of Yaakov about not wanting to kill unnecessarily, I wrote attributed to Golda Meir because it appeared in an autobiography that was published during her lifetime by someone who was close to her. And at the same time, those who have dug through trying to find which speech she said it in or whatever have had a hard time trying to actually find it. Yes. So it's attributed to Golda Meir. And it's an important point. We have this crisis of, on the one hand, we are supposed to be merciful. That's our identity. And at the same time, we have to defend ourselves. So we do the best we can with it. I'm going to stick around to answer questions and discuss, but because we're already about 50, 53 minutes in, I'll let people go who have to go.